It's been wonderful too to work with Ragnar, you know, because Christian student work is very important. When I went to Cambridge in 1962, I was welcomed by students who were believers. And now that I'm a parent and have had children going to college and university, I've been so grateful that there has been an organization like KFS to really do something among the universities. So I think Ragnar and people like him around the world in over 150 countries, they do a much greater work than many people realize. So it's a pleasure, and I'm so encouraged to see the way the churches have rallied around him and put on sessions like this. Now, our topic tonight is God in the public square. It is a massively important topic because the pressure in our society today in the West is to keep God private. You can talk about anything, but you mustn't talk about God in public. You keep it to yourself. And that pressure is so great that I meet many people. They go to church. They read their Bible. They say their prayers. But they've long since lost any dimension of articulating their faith in public. In other words, their faith in God has closed in on themselves, and it has ceased to be evangelical, and it has ceased to be orientated to the world outside. Now, that's a tragedy, because I'm a Christian. Why? Because a man called Paul risked his life coming to Europe centuries ago, and because other people risked their lives coming to my island. And those of you who are here are Christians are here because other people bothered to get out of their comfort zone and to come to these islands. And so it's very important that we have the same attitude. The New Testament is very clear that, and it's the Apostle Peter that tells us this, which is very important. He says we're to be always ready to give an answer that to those who ask us a reason concerning the hope that is within us. And there are two important words there. To give an answer, an apologia, a defense. The moment you open your mouth in a multicultural, pluralistic society about your Christian faith, people will misunderstand it. They will misrepresent it. And they may even give you a lot of trouble. So you have to defend what you believe. And we have to give reasons. But the very interesting thing is this. Always be ready to give an answer to people who ask you. Peter imagines dialogue as the crucial element in the communication of the Christian faith in the public space. Now, I am at the University of Oxford, where we believe in the Socratic method of teaching. That is teaching by dialogue, by constantly asking questions. And it is my deep conviction, as I read the New Testament, I find Jesus constantly in discussion with the disciples, asking them questions. Who do you think I am? Who do men say that I am? He was interested in what they thought other people thought. Who do you think I am? And he constantly asked questions. And I do believe that we have a real opportunity to get into dialogue. And for those of you who are Christian, I would just ask you, which people are you actively in dialogue with now? You can answer that yourself. Now, I'm not going to talk about that in detail tonight, because what I sense around the world is a lack of confidence in the truth of Christianity That means that many people keep it out of the public space. Now, I realize there may be many people here who do not share the Christian faith. Thank you so much for coming. Because it may be of interest to you to hear some of the things that motivate those of us who are Christians. Now, we're talking about God in the public space. And as you look through history, there are certain people who've made a tremendous impact on the world because of their faith in God. It is common for many vocal atheists like Richard Dawkins to suggest that God is to blame for all the evil in the world. Well, that just is false. But what they often forget is the vast legacy that Christianity has left in our history. Where did hospitals come from? Christianity. Where did hospices come from? Christianity. Where did the major European universities come from? Christianity. Where did human rights legislation come from? Christianity. And there's so much that one of the continent's leading intellectuals, a man called Jürgen Habermas, he's an atheist. He says all of these fundamental things come directly from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And then he adds this. He says, to this day, we in Europe have no other source. Everything else is idle, useless, that is, postmodern chatter. That's a very interesting statement by an atheist. So the first thing to say is this. There is a record implanted in history. And it's a very positive thing. There are negative things, of course, and I talked about those last night. But it's very important to see that the teaching of Christ and the effect of his apostles in the end stopped slavery through William Wilberforce. That is a huge thing. Because you know, tonight there are many countries where people are still enslaved. So the first thing I want to say is God in the public space, people who have ventured into the public space believing in God have had a huge effect. You've heard of Martin Luther as a reformer. What's much less known is his enormous effect as an educationalist. He had a colossal effect on education. Indeed, Luther, William Tyndale, and people like that really brought literacy to our countries. Everywhere Christianity went, it spread education. It didn't stop it, it started it. And so there's this huge legacy which at the present time is being pushed down. I've been encouraged recently in some things that have happened in the United Kingdom, where even our Prime Minister is beginning to see that it is important that there is a public space for God. But what I want to do tonight is to go to one of the most powerful men in history who was a believer. I do not know of anyone else who did what he did. He was at the head of two world empires, not one, but two. That has never happened before or since. His name, as some of you may know, was Daniel. And I want to tell you his story. Because as an older man, having been the leader at the top of the organization of the massive Babylonian Empire, and then taken over the Medo-Persian Empire, as an old man, he writes to younger people like us to tell us what he saw from his position of power that kept him so stable that he never lost his witness publicly to God. Daniel was not a man who kept his faith in God in a box. And if a man rises to such power and shares with us some of his secret, then I find that enormously helpful. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of his story, because I think it's one of the most powerful stories in the whole of the Bible that resonates directly into the 21st century, as you will see. Daniel was possibly 14 or 15 year old when he was captured by the Babylonian forces under Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor. He'd grown up in a Jewish believing home. He'd been named Daniel because his parents believed that there was a God who watched over their children. God is my judge, they called their boy. And then the vast armies of Babylon poured in, and because Daniel was brilliant and was of the nobility of Judea, he was taken captive and removed several hundred kilometers to a completely new situation. He entered the largest city in the ancient world. Jerusalem was tiny compared with it. He saw its architecture and its magnificence. They were brilliant engineers. They'd constructed some of the biggest buildings in the world. It was a city of about 250,000. It was colossal. They're mathematics. They were geniuses. Look at your watches. You're wearing a trace of Babylon on your watches, aren't you? 60 seconds in a minute. 60 minutes in an hour. Where does that come from? Babylon. They worked to the base 60, and it has stuck. They were brilliant at medicine, at music, at the arts. And here were these four young men coming to King's College Babylon. A totally new culture, a completely new language. Many gods, not just one god. How would they bear witness to God, just the four of them? It is a stirring story, you know. And of course, they were heartbroken leaving their parents. But the interesting thing is, of course, in time, they began to get over that. And so they entered King's College Babylon. Let me read a bit to you about what happens in this story. Because there are principles right at the beginning. The story starts like this. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. And we learn later that the four, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were brought. Now this is fascinating. The first point that's made in the book is stunning. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And any modern historian would say, don't be so stupid. Goodness me, bringing God into history. I mean, look, this is simple survival of the fittest. You have a tiny little nation called Judah, and you have a huge big nation called Babylon with all the rockets, machine guns, army and everything else. Of course they wiped out Judah. And yet, Daniel is interpreting history. And he's saying God was behind that. So the first lesson he wants to teach us is this. He had a strong conviction that God is over world history. And we later learn that he had a equally strong conviction that God was in control of his own history. Do you believe that? Perhaps you don't even believe there is a God. To start off with that there is a God and it is in control of history is making a staggeringly big statement. It's challenging the atheism, the polytheism of the ancient world, and the atheism of today. It took a brave man to suggest that God was behind something that was obviously a matter of a bigger power against a lesser power. But you see, Daniel later explains why he thought God was in control. Because he tells us in his chapter 9, as he weeps over the ruin of Jerusalem, he said, you know, the trouble with us was we didn't keep the laws that God had given us. God is a moral God. And we didn't really listen. We played at religion. And the prophets came and they told us, look, if you compromise morally in your business and in your politics, and if you compromise with the paganism around, you will end up in the most idolatrous country in the ancient world. And prophet after prophet came and told them. And they didn't listen. So in the end, first Israel and then Judah were swept away into captivity. Let's get this. Daniel's faith in God was not destroyed by that earthquake in history that affected him very negatively. Why? Because he believed the prophets. He believed what the word of God had said. And so that stabilized him so that he didn't say, what an absurdity to believe that God has revealed himself to our nation. I mean to say, we thought that the living God lived in our temple. Wasn't that pathetic, really? Nebuchadnezzar came into the temple, removed the stuff in it, and what did God do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But Daniel wasn't so superficial as that. Because he'd read the prophets. And he knew that this is a moral universe. And that's one of his principles of leadership and success and survival, was his concept of integrity and morality. These are big things, aren't they? So first of all, there's God's control of history. And that's sometimes hard to hold on to, isn't it? When your life is going well, it's easy to say, oh, well, God is with me. And then cancer strikes, or you lose a child, or you lose a relative. And then comes the question, is there a God who is in control? It raises that question in the first few sentences. But now the next thing, very odd thing. Before Daniel tells us about his captivity, he tells us a very odd story. He says, when Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor, came to the temple, he went into it and he took the vessels out of it and he took them home and he put them in his temple. Well, what on earth has that got to do with anything? I mean, if you'd been writing this book, would you have put that in? Fancy being interested in a tiny detail like that. Ah, but it doesn't only say he put the vessels in his temple. He put the vessels in his treasure house. What does that raise the question of? Values, ladies and gentlemen. The first question is history. The second is values. Now, I want you to think hard about what's happening here. What were those vessels? They were made of gold and silver. They came from the temple of God at Jerusalem, and they were symbols of God's utter holiness. They were a symbol that God was the absolute value. Oh, that's a big statement, isn't it? Are there absolute values, do you think? Or are all values relative? We keep being told that all values are relative and all truth is relative. And that's nonsense, of course, logically, because the person that tells you that all truth is relative, then what they're saying is relative. They're expecting you to believe as an absolute truth that all truth is relative. And that's nonsense. And you'll find, of course, that every one of us believes in truth. I notice you're all here. You believe the truth that there would be a lecture at 7:30, didn't you? You've got concepts of absolute truth, of course. But this is not simply truth. It's the question of truth in the realm of values. Are there absolute values? That's one of the biggest issues at the heart of our society today. We are the first or second generation where the ultimate value of human life is being questioned. The sacredness of marriage. The sacredness of you as a person. For centuries in Europe, God has been the measure of value. And now God is being abolished. So you, well, you are a human being, but there are millions of other species that are just as important as you. And one leading scientist said to me not long ago, he said, we're suffering from an epidemic of primatomania. Too many primates, let's get rid of a whole lot of them, including humans. He said, why don't we let the ants take over the world? After all, there are far more of them than there are of us. He was serious. And the leading bioethicist in the world, Peter Singer, whom I've debated, says exactly that. You see, he says what's wrong with our society is that we have publicly declared human beings to be special because they're created in the image of God. That has been responsible for many of our problems because we've allowed these human beings in the name of God to destroy the planet. So the answer is what? To demote humanity. Forget the image of God. Well, what do we think of that? Well, I think it's entirely wrong, and I've written about it. I haven't time to explore tonight. All I want to point out to you tonight, this was written 26 centuries ago, and it's raising the big issues of God in the public square. Here is Daniel, and he believed in those values. When Christians pray, our Father who are in heaven, hallowed be your name. That old word hallowed means holy. It means set apart. It means absolutely special. That was the guiding principle for all morality. And add to that what it says in the Old Testament in Genesis. God created man and woman in his own image. That's where our values come from. They're being abolished. Daniel left Jerusalem behind. Now watch what Nebuchadnezzar did. This is the interesting thing. He took those vessels which symbolized absolute value to Daniel and his friends. And he put them in his museum. Museums, you know, are full of stolen. I mean, they're full of all kinds of very beautiful and valuable things. And many of them are, of course, stolen, as you know. He had a huge series of museums. You can see some of the stuff still in the British Museum. Don't ask how it got there, but it's there. And you can see the brilliance of the artwork and so on. So he had his museum with little sections for all of the countries he'd conquered. And there was a tiny little bit marked Judah with some nice glass windows, and there were the vessels. What had he done? Think about it. He'd taken something that was to Daniel of absolute value, and he'd made it of relative value. Does that resonate with you? Of course. It's exactly what's happening in our society, in the public square. Things that were long regarded as absolute are now relative. You want to believe in God? Well, that's fine. You do that if you find it helpful. But please don't mention it in public, because there are other people around. Oh, it's very subtle. What Nebuchadnezzar did was to relativize the absolute. And it won't be very long before he's doing the opposite thing. He's absolutizing the relative. That's what happens. That's what Daniel noticed happened when people get power. They're in danger of relativizing the absolute, but then they cannot live without absolutes, so they have to take something of relative value like power, money, sex, influence, and they make that an absolute. Or they do what Nebuchadnezzar did, and he makes the state an absolute. And he does that in chapter 3. And Daniel wasn't in Babylon at the time. And Nebuchadnezzar made the state an absolute. And he said to all his executives and leaders and politicians, you will appear and you will bow down at this huge statue. And that raised the question of values, ladies and gentlemen, like they'd never heard it before. What would you do if you were asked to come to Tórshavn on Saturday and bow down in the name of some pagan god in the market square to prove your allegiance? What would you do? They were faced with that, weren't they? This is a story of the three young men in the fiery furnace. And people say, but God delivered them. And they never suffered. They suffered utter agony before the furnace. You imagine. I've often done it because I've met people who've been not quite in this situation, but near it. Coming home from your office and saying, my dear, Nebuchadnezzar has organized a big ceremony and he wants us to bow before his gods. Oh, yes. And I'm not going to do it. But why not? I mean, we know there's nothing in these gods. They're all fictitious mythology. I'm not going to do it. But Nebuchadnezzar is going to have you thrown in a fire. Still not going to do it. What would you say to your kids? Dad? You're not going to do it. What about Mom? What about us? Where are your values? And you see, this story, which is so powerful, raises the ultimate question. What is the ultimate value? It's not even my life, said Daniel's three friends. And Nebuchadnezzar thought he could control these people publicly because he thought there was no one in his empire who had a higher value than their own personal life. And he was wrong. He discovered there were three for whom God was the bigger value. How would you feel about that? I'd be terrified, wouldn't you? I remember the first man I met who'd spent 7 years in the gulag because he taught children Christianity. He was a little man, much shorter than me. And he told me about this, and he said, I had to go to the gulag. And then he smiled up at me, and he said, you couldn't do that. And I felt so ashamed. I just crumpled inside, and I said, no, I couldn't do that. I'm sure I couldn't do that. And then he smiled again, and he said, neither could I. He said, what I discovered is this, that God is not real in a hypothetical situation, but he's real in a real situation. And he said, look, he said, I saw things in the gulag that no man should ever have to see. And I was a man who fainted every time my nose bled. And he said, what I discovered was this. When it came to standing, God helped me stand when I needed his help. I never forget that lesson. It was like it came out of this book of Daniel. But it challenged me, as it has in all of my life, what are my values? If you're going to have influence for God in the public space, you've got to ask that question. Oh, you've got to ask it. You see, I meet many people and they say to me, well, you know, when I become a professor, I'll start to witness for God. Or I'm new in a company and when I am CEO and of the power, I'll start. You never will. You never will. We've got to make up our mind. Now, that doesn't mean we're silly. And we turn up in the company every morning and send our verse for the day to all the employees. But it means we make a decision in our hearts that we're going to be counted. These men did. It was the secret of their power. It's why I'm sitting here 26 centuries after this happened. And all of us know that there's something very deep going on in this story. But there's a lot more to it. The question of history is first. The question of values is second. Oh, by the way, you will remember how important those vessels are. Because at the climax of this book, there is a feast. You remember Belshazzar's feast? Which has been set to music and has been the subject of some of the most brilliant paintings in the world by Rembrandt and others. When Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, made a huge feast for 1,000 of his top people. And he knew about these vessels. He knew where they were. And he commanded his servants to go and get them and put them on the table. And then he said to the assembled throng, he said, drink to them. Drink to the gods of wood and steel and stone, the pagan gods. And they picked up those beautiful vessels and they started to drink. And in that moment, a hand started to write on the wall. The writing on the wall. It's an expression in every language I know and a good deal I don't know. And what did it write? They couldn't understand it. They were terrified. Well, if it had been writing in the 21st century, it would probably have written a pound symbol, a euro symbol, and a dollar symbol. Something like that. They'd seen those marks on weights and measures and money. It simply said values. And it was too late. And the entire empire fell because of what Belshazzar did with those vessels. They're very important. Very important. What are your values? Is integrity important to me? If we're going to have influence in the public space, we've got to face these questions, haven't we? And God stood by these men and encouraged them. But they were just students still. There's much more to learn. Let's look at the next lesson briefly. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar was a very clever educator. He took the best people from the nations he'd conquered, educated them for 3 years free, gave them his food, which was the best food in the nation by definition. And then the very best of them he kept in Babylon, and the rest of them he sent back to their home countries to rule them. So here were these three men. Four men, Daniel and his three friends. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And I like to imagine the first evening they met Babylonian students in the university refectory, the dining hall, the university. So come with me to the dining hall. And you can imagine, here's a young Babylonian, let's say his name's Nabu. It's a name taken from the moon god. And he meets these things. Oh, nice to meet you. Who are you? Well, I'm Daniel. You're what? I'm Daniel. You're not a Babylonian, are you? No, actually, I'm not. Your name, I mean, my name's taken from the moon god. What about your name? Well, it's Daniel. It means God is my judge. Pardon? God is your what? Ah! Oh. You must be one of these Hebrews, are you? Oh, poor chap, I feel really sorry for you. I mean, I know Nebuchadnezzar beat you up recently, but are you surprised? if you've got a concept of God as your judge, it's not surprising you were beaten up. What a miserable idea of God to have. Some of us are going up to the temple tonight, and there'll be plenty of girls, and you really learn what the gods are when they get into you tonight. Just half a minute, said Daniel. Aren't you a law student? Yes. And we've got a class in law tomorrow. That's right. And you're hoping to be a lawyer, possibly a judge. Yes. So you believe in judgment, do you? Well, yes, of course I do. Is there an ultimate justice? Where does law come from? You can see the discussion going. You see, my parents named me Daniel. God is my judge, because they believed that behind our human judgments, there was a God who's real, who's the guarantor that there's a moral standard. And you could see the discussion going until one of the others got impatient and said, Daniel, just a minute, I ought to tell him what my name is. My name's Hananiah. And what does that mean? Well, it means God, the God of grace. Grace? I thought you said God was a judge. Oh, I see. You believe in the grace God, you believe in the judge God. No, says Mishael. There is only one God. That's what my name means. Mishael. Who is like God? There's only one. And you can see the Babylonian saying, look, hey, calm down. Let's sort this out. Are you saying to me that there is a God, not a polytheistic set of gods, but a God who is a judge and a God who shows grace? And he's unique. And then old Azariah, he would come in at the end and he'd say, you know, do you know what my name means? It essentially means God has helped. This is real, gentlemen. We're not talking fairy stories. It's real. Do you notice that they could have used their names to make powerful witness to the nature of the God they believed in? That's why they weren't allowed to. Because before they could get started, they were given pagan names. Daniel was named after Marduk, the chief god of Babylon. And Hananiah was called Shadrach, after Aku, the moon god. Mishael was called Meshach. He suffered most because Meshach is a twisting of his Hebrew name. Who is like Aku is? And Azariah named after one of the other gods. They weren't going to be allowed. Because you see, Nebuchadnezzar was clever. He was making them all the same. That's what he wants to do with you. That's what society wants to do with you. Cut them down. Anybody that's distinctive, anybody that stands up for a unique God is likely to disrupt this nation. So we cut them down. We make everybody the same. Have you ever heard that before in history? Oh, this is very important stuff. It's showing us just little pictures of the big issues that Daniel regarded as important. We can't help the names people call us, but it's wonderful, you know. They changed Daniel's name, they changed the other three names. But you notice when you get to the end of the book, he's still being called Daniel. His name survived, the empire did not. Is your name going to survive? What is your name? Because there's a big story here. This is Babylon. It's not Torshavn, nor is Jerusalem, nor is it London or New York. It's Babylon. Why is that important? Well, do you know your history, ladies and gentlemen? What's Babylon famous for? A skyscraper. Do you remember that? Isn't it interesting how every city in the world wants to have the biggest skyscraper? There's a whole literature about why we build skyscrapers. And it all surrounds huge egos. Behind every skyscraper, a sociologist has written, there's an even bigger ego. That's why they build them. But Babylon, we are told in Genesis, was building a ziggurat, a skyscraper. We've got some of the measurements of it, actually, and mathematical drawings of similar things, was to reach the heavens. And they said, you know, if we don't come together, let's make a name for ourselves and build a tower that will reach to heaven. Notice, let's make a name for ourselves. Names. Babylon is in the business of changing names. Is that important? What does Babylon stand for? Well, it says so. It stands for the restless motivation of human beings to make a name for themselves. What do you think of that? Do you think that's a good thing? You say, what's wrong with having a name? Absolutely nothing. But making it for yourself and building yourself up till you reach to heaven. It's almost an amusing story because it goes on to say, and the Lord came down to have a look at their city. There's a big distance between the top of it and heaven. The Lord had to come down to have a look at it. And God called a man called Abram, who was an ancestor of Daniel. And he said, get out, and I will make your name great. There are two ways of living. The Bible is a tale of two cities. There's Babylon, which stands for, I'm going to make my name great. And there's the city Abram looked for, where God says, I will make your name great. And as I sit here, ladies and gentlemen, oh, I think of this so often. I believe the eternal city is real. But so often in life, if we're honest, there's a battle, isn't there? Can we really trust God for our identity? And the tragedy is, when we lose our confidence in God for our identity, our witness in the public square will disappear very rapidly. Where do I get my identity? Now, that's a topic we could talk about for a week. I'm just indicating to you that it's one of the topics he raises, but I must go very rapidly because I want to give you lots of times questions. Then they decided to protest against the food. Now, I know most students protest against the food that they're offered in university. I've seen it many times, and I mustn't comment on the Pharaohs. I'm sure it's wonderful food. But this was the very best food. And Daniel came to the official and he said, I don't want to eat this food. I don't want to drink this wine. Now, there's endless speculation as to why he said that. Idols are not mentioned here, but Babylon was utterly full of idols. And of course, the universities would have been like my university. Before dinner, in the college on a Thursday night, and I do it sometimes myself, I say grace in Latin because the university is a Christian institution originally. And you can imagine in a huge King's College Babylon, there would be all kinds of religious things. I can't prove this to you, but I noticed that Daniel didn't simply refuse the food, he refused the wine. Now, later in the book, we learn that Daniel did drink wine, so that wasn't the issue. Why did he refuse the wine? My suspicion is this. There are two big issues in chapter one. There's the golden vessels, and there's the refusal of the food and wine. They're brought together at the climactic banquet at Belshazzar's feast, where those vessels are used to drink wine to the pagan gods. And I just wonder if Daniel, as a student, had a sense that if I start compromising now, it'll end up with that. He was only 15. I find that stunning. He didn't know a thousandth of what I know about the Bible. Most of it hadn't been written. And yet he got the courage. Four of them against the entire... Well, what were they really saying? They were studying and enjoying it, I'm sure. They were studying the language and literature of the Chaldeans. They were going to be top civil servants and officials. They didn't run away from it and run into the desert and form a little cave and hide from the world. Daniel was doing what the prophets had told him to do, to seek the blessing of the city. Abram was called out, Daniel was sent back. That's what God does, of course, doesn't he? Some Christians, you know, sadly get it into their heads that they're called out and they never get sent back and they end up in a ghetto. But Daniel was sent back because once a man has learned to trust God, you can safely send him back into the very culture from which his ancestors had originally come. And instead of being engulfed by that culture, he blesses it and he benefits it. So Daniel accepted the education. What was he protesting about? Now, this is a huge challenge to me. I'm in a famous university. It has a Christian foundation, but it's almost completely secular. Daniel, I believe, protested against the idolatrous interpretation of the universe that lay behind the education system. In the United Kingdom, the default worldview is atheistic naturalism. I don't accept it. I live in a university where it is dominant, but I'm not prepared to lie down under it. So I have to protest. How do I protest? Well, not by refusing the food at my college. That's what he did in his day. What do we do in our day? I don't know. You'll have to decide that for yourselves. I have to decide it for myself. And it is part of the maturing in life that we learn where to set the protest. You see, God in the public space is a delicate thing. There's no record of them protesting against the change in their names. But there is record of them protesting against the food. So Daniel says to the official, please, we don't want to eat the food. And the man got frightened stiff. Now Daniel must have been a very friendly young man. This is lovely, this next bit. And the man said, look, why should the king see you looking worse than everybody else? That's not identity, ladies and gentlemen. That's image. Is that an important issue to you in the public space? What is my image? If you look worse than the others, if I change your food, whoosh, my head will come off. And Daniel was very nice to him. He said, look, I tell you what, just do an experiment. It's the first controlled trial in history for those of you interested in epidemiology. Just do an experiment and test us for 10 days and judge by what you see. Image. Oh my, oh my, oh my. My mind goes back. Forgive a personal story. I was 19. I tried to talk about God at high table with some very senior professors, and one was a Nobel Prize winner. And he said, Lennox, I want you in my room afterwards. So I went to his room. He had three other professors there. One student, me. He sat me down. Said, do you want a career in science? I said, yes, sir, I do. Well, he said, give up these childish notions of God. They'll cripple you. You'll look far worse than everybody else. You'll never make it. So give them up. That was pressure. Image. What did he think of me? So I said, sir, what have you got to offer me that's better than what I've got? And he came out with some ancient philosophy that I had heard of, but most haven't. It's called Bergsonianism, and don't worry if you've never heard of it. And when he'd finished, I said, sir, if you don't mind, I'll stick with what I've got. But I never forgot it. We're going to stand for God in the public space, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have to sort out the matter of our image, because we all get scared. Identity and image are the two biggest questions. So many young people, my heart goes out to them. They live in a different world from me, where all the stabilities that I knew as a child have disappeared. And they want an identity. Of course they do. And they don't want to look bad. And the pressure comes, well, just keep quiet about your God then. And so God never gets into the public space. But the result of this was that the young men turned out better than everybody else. And you say, isn't that marvelous? If I follow God in the university, I'm going to get the very best degree. Not necessarily, you're not. That's what happened to them. It's not guaranteed it'll happen to you. But I hope you begin to see, there's a whole book full of this, by the way. We're only starting, we're scratching. But these basic principles that relate to public witness to God, they are the reason Daniel never shut up and was able to carry high office, enormously high office, and to the very end of his days as an old man, remain true to his faith in God. And here we read it 26 centuries later. Do you realize what's in this book of Daniel? Its chapter 4 was not written by Daniel. It was written by the emperor. It's his testimony of how he came to know God through Daniel's witness. Wouldn't you like to have a document written by world leaders telling how they came to faith, wouldn't you? Well, here's one. That's probably why it's written in Aramaic, because everybody could read Aramaic. That young man in university made such an impression that when the time was ripe, he stood in that vast throne room of Babylon where Nebuchadnezzar was terrified by a dream he'd had. And as perhaps a 20-year-old, and the emperor looks at this young man and he says, can you interpret dreams, can you? And Daniel says, there isn't a man on earth that can tell the king his dream. And then these next words, they almost give me goose pimples. But there is a God in heaven, your majesty. Wow, that's magnificent. Utterly magnificent. And you know, there's something in me, and I'll be honest with you, I covet that courage. There is a God in heaven. And I trust your moment will come. When, whether you're terrified or not, you're able to say, there is a God in heaven. That's just the start, of course. We know far more than he did. And that shames me. But all I know, how weak and how embarrassed and fearful I get. Tragic, isn't it? Since we started this evening, ladies and gentlemen, I wonder how many believers have been shot or executed or been beheaded because they've taken the same stand as Daniel. There have been many, I'm sure. It seems unreal, doesn't it? We don't face that, not yet. But why is it then we get scared of much smaller things? That's the question. Thank you very much for listening.